The whole question of Christian attitudes toward war was simply never discussed in my childhood at all. I don't recall it was ever brought up in connection with confirmation or any place along the way. I can remember as a boy on the farm out there east of Blue Earth near Dell and Frost and Brush Creek in southern Minnesota, not so far from some of these places from which you've come, some of you have come. I remember we had a hired man once in a while during the haying time and so on in the summer. And I remember a couple of specific things in connection with that. I remember one time mentioning to him that we were then in the middle of the Second World War. I mentioned to him that we have all this killing going on. The Bible says in the Ten Commandments, you should not kill. And his immediate reply to that was, that commandment doesn't count during wartime. And I think that's been the basic approach. Now I realize in studying the Ten Commandments, if you want to take that literally in a historic sense, meaning you should do no murder, and in its context, it was not understood to prohibit all war. And yet, I sometimes think in terms of if we made the same kind of application of the sixth commandment, you should not commit adultery, and we applied that also in the same way it was understood back in the Old Testament times, where people or men often had many wives and concubines and so on, and some pastor of the American Lutheran Church or any of our Christian churches were to start practicing the sixth commandment in the way in which we often teach and practice the fifth commandment, I think we might get into some trouble. I remember, too, this same hired man saying to me one day as we were riding back on a load of hay that I was lucky because I had polio when I was a couple years old, and he said, "You're lucky, you'll never have to go to war." Now, when I heard that, I did not like it at all. I was caught up in the spirit of the Second World War, you know, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. I can remember Pearl Harbor vaguely. I can remember the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima as being a great day, tremendous day of victory for us and great power for our country. So I want to say that I certainly have not come out of a pacifist kind of background at all. My first acquaintance with pacifism was in a lecture I heard by a gentleman whose name I believe is Howard Lutz, who was a Quaker, taught at St. Olaf College, and I went to hear him when I was a student there, and I remember to this day a number of things that he said because they were entirely new to me. He talked about how we did not defeat the devil with the devil's weapons. He quoted some teachings of Jesus with which I had some familiarity about loving your enemies and so on, but I just had never, ever thought to apply those questions to the matter of war at all. And so I think that I come out of the kind of background that I think that many of us have come from as Lutherans, and perhaps not only Lutherans, maybe Congregationalists and other people as well. I don't know all of your backgrounds on that score. I'm interested in this question not only in terms of the politics of hope. That's one of the main themes here at Holden. I'm interested in that. I'm interested in politics. I have a twin brother who's one of the United States congressmen from Minnesota. We talk politics a lot. I get involved a lot in political kind of discussions. But as I try to deal with these questions, to do so not just in terms of a narrowly, exclusively political perspective, but to deal with them in a Christian perspective. I think we're dealing here with issues that are faith issues. They're questions of our faith and of morality. And that I want to try to share some things in terms of my own perspective at the present time on these questions, recognizing that we deal with an extremely complex and difficult subject of many, many aspects. And I want to try to put together, and I put together ordered my thought a bit here in terms of some ideas on these matters, and I'd like to run through that, and then I hope we have some time at the end for some discussion of these questions. I really have planned here a two-part series. The first part of it is a new look at war. The second part is scheduled for Thursday morning at 10:45, I think it is, on the board up there, a new look at alternatives to war. I think it's important for us not just to take a stand against war. We have to have some moral and functional equivalence of war. There have to be some structures have to be developed to seek to solve human conflicts that so far we attempt to solve by means of war. But that's getting a little ahead of the story. I stress that the title I pick here is A New Look at War. And I'd like to begin with what has now become to be a famous quotation from Albert Einstein, And I quote this, I have an article in the last issue, the summer issue of Word and World magazine, that I was asked to do on the task and challenge of prophetic peacemaking. This matter of peacemaking, incidentally, has become a subject that is extremely important to me, and I'm grateful that that wonderful congregation back there, University Lutheran Church of Hope, gave me the privilege of having a four-month study leave earlier this year from January into May when Carol and I were out in Boston. And I tried during that four-month period to gather some thoughts and study and ponder specifically on this question. But I begin with this quotation from Albert Einstein. The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything save our modes of thinking, and we thus drift toward unparalleled catastrophe. As early as 1946, Einstein had come to believe that a new type of thinking, and here I quote Einstein again, a new type of thinking is essential if mankind is to survive and move toward higher levels. Einstein believed that to maintain the threat of military power was to cling to old methods in a world which has changed forever. Note that first part of that again. The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything save our modes of thinking, and we thus drift toward unparalleled catastrophe. I suppose it's easy for us to talk about living in new eras, and people have always done that with more or less truth, perhaps. But I think there is a sense in which it is profoundly true that we live in a new era. The human race, we human beings, have a capacity for the first time in human history. No other people who've ever lived have the capacity we have, and that is the capacity for the virtual destruction of civilization and possibly of all human life on this planet. Hitler or Alexander the Great or Napoleon, none of them had that kind of capacity. And we live in a new era. It requires new thinking. And so what I want to try to do is to approach this new look at war, both in terms of a new look at some things in the New Testament, and we'll get into more of that probably in the second session as well, but a new look also at war in terms of the new situation, the development of the doomsday weapons. Not only, of course, the nuclear weapons, but also the chemical and biological and who knows what else the military planners may have up their sleeve these days. I begin with a couple of assumptions. The first assumption is that I do not believe it is the intentional will of God that we human beings should solve our problems by killing one another. And the second assumption is I do not believe that war as an established institution is a permanent part of human history. I know what the Bible says about wars and rumors of wars and all of that. I think what that means is as long as there are going to be sinful human beings in this world, we're always going to have conflict. There are going to be situations of conflict in the world. That does not mean that war as an institution, as the kind of institution that has been established and by and large, in effect, accepted for the settling of problems between nations, I do not think that that kind of institution is going to exist forever. It's been said, and I think rightly, that war as that kind of institution is going to be abolished from the face of the earth either before or after the next world war. I think we do well to ponder that. War is going to be destroyed. If need be, it'll be destroyed by war itself, the same way in which a cancer destroys itself by destroying the body in which it lives. And so it is that war may end. There will be a war that will end all wars, the destruction of humanity and of civilization itself. I could pause here and talk at some length about this distinction between conflict in a sinful world and war as an institution. I think that's a very important distinction to make. Maybe I get ahead of myself, but as it's in my mind, I will just use an illustration in connection with this, that we can have discussion about is it ever right to kill somebody? And most of us, I think, would come up with situations, unique kind of circumstances, where we say, yeah, it may be right for us in this circumstance. Somebody's gone berserk with a rifle and they're up in the window shooting somebody and you happen to, they're just blowing up everybody. You may have to kill that person. There may be those tragic circumstances. But there's a very great difference from the act in that tragic circumstance and jumping from that to the institutionalizing of war. There's a parallel to this. I don't think it's totally far-fetched. We might ask the question, is it ever right to steal? I think most of us, again, might say there are unique circumstances. Your children are starving. You tried everything else you can't think of. You know, there are all kinds of food there. Maybe going to waste is right for you to steal it and feed your children. Or you steal the gun from the person who's going to commit a crime. You can think of those kind of examples. But to think of institutionalized stealing, official government stealing, a department of stealing, established to steal either from ourselves or more likely to steal from other countries, we have a little problem with that. I think it's important to recognize that a war is not just a spontaneous kind of action that occurs in situations of conflict, as we might get into a fight with each other and one of us kill each other. War is planned and studied and organized and developed and structured as a whole military, industrial, bureaucratic, scientific, et cetera, complex that has created this institution of war making. And I think that's very important for us to keep in mind. Still, in terms of a little bit on these kind of preliminary things, in terms of war being abolished, one of the most interesting lectures that I heard out at in Boston was a lecture given by Freeman Dyson at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dyson's the author of a fascinating book called Disturbing the Universe and many other things. Anyway, he talked about how the very use of these doomsday weapons, in effect, has ended war already, if they're going to be used. That is, what would take place in the use of these doomsday weapons really is not war. It is a technological bloodbath. And he said that what the people who ought to be the chief opponents of these weapons should be the military, because the development of these weapons has destroyed war. It has destroyed war in the historic sense of war, in which you have winners and losers and heroes and all of that kind of stuff, the great glamour that goes into that kind of conflict. It's all over. There's the pushing of some buttons and there is annihilation. And you should not even, in one sense, speak of that as war. And there are, of course, people in the military, such as the people from the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C., Jean LaRoc and others, who are among the leading opponents of the use of these weapons. Now, as we think about these things, one of the responses that I have received in discussing these things elsewhere is to say, well, it's maybe nice to talk about this, but this is very naive kind of business. And yet I would just invite you to think of the fact that this may not be very naive at all. What we are dealing with here is not just a question of war or peace. We're dealing with a question of war versus human survival itself. And I don't want to go into a lot of detail about this, but if it seems to be, to any of you, to be an exaggeration, speak in these terms, then there are several things that I hope you do. I hope one thing you do before you leave here, if you can, is to see the film Hiroshima Nagasaki, that Jerry Folk has brought along. He's going to be, I don't know if Jerry's here this afternoon, but he's going to be dealing with some similar themes to what I'm dealing with beginning this week. I hope you see that. If you can look at that film all the way through without averting your eyes or getting kind of sick to your stomach, then you have more of a certain kind of fortitude than I have. Those were little bombs, 12, 15 kiloton, equivalent of 12 to 15,000 tons of TNT. Many of the bombs that are developed now are measured in terms of million tons of TNT. I heard someone say once that a million tons of TNT is equal to a railroad car of TNT over 300 miles long. Some of these bombs are over 10 megatons. That's equivalent to a train reaching just about across the whole United States. We're dealing here with things that are just really kind of beyond our imagination. I hope that if you have not studied some of these things on this, that you take a look at some of this, the bare facts about it, that we in the United States now have about 30,000 nuclear warheads, various kinds and sizes, Soviet Union some 20,000. I heard a physician from Harvard Medical School comment when we were in the East that if one megaton bomb was exploded over the city of Boston, they have calculations that there would be 400,000 serious burn fatalities. I don't know if you've had the experience of standing by a burn patient in the hospital, emergency burn unit of a hospital. Think about 400,000 from one bomb. He said that in the whole city of Boston, they've got 35 or so hospital beds for burn patients. If they get more than four a week, he said they're overcrowded. And of course, Very likely those hospital facilities themselves would be destroyed. I talked with Costas Sippas, who's a physicist at MIT. He's also in another film you may see called The Final Epidemic. And he said they're involved in studies there with considerable concern that the use of even a portion of all of these weapons might so deplete the ozone layer that every living creature in the world that had eyes that could not be fitted with special sunglasses of some kind might go blind because of the depletion of the ozone layer. Now, maybe that's an exaggeration. I don't know. Maybe Jonathan Schell exaggerates when, in his book, The Fate of the Earth, he talks about not only the death of millions of people, but the possible death of the species itself. And yet, we don't know for sure. This is kind of a game of gambling or chance we're involved in. We do not know what the specific consequences of that kind of use of these weapons would be. When we're out east, I happened to pick up a copy of a book, a fascinating book called The Doomsday Book of Animals. And it's a book that talks about all the animals and birds and stuff that have become extinct in the world. And I was especially struck by the fact, and I don't know if you knew this, I didn't know this, that about 150 years or so ago, they estimate that 40% of all the birds in North America were passenger pigeons. They tell about how audubon traveled riding all day, seeing flocks of passenger pigeons that darken the sky. They estimate flocks in the billions of birds. And if anybody had gone around to audubon and said, you know, in 100 years, there won't be one of those left in the world, they said, you're crazy. You can't get rid of them. They're absolute nuisance. And yet the last passenger pigeon in the whole world died in a zoo in 1912. Now we wonder, we ask, it's a serious question, will there be human beings living on this planet 100 years from now? That's not a joke, that's a serious question. Will the earth, instead of being inhabited by human beings, be inhabited instead by cockroaches and other creatures who are much more able to survive radiation than we human beings are? Anyway, I raise these questions to prompt us to take a new look at war. I don't know what is going to happen, but I'm sure that if it does happen, if somehow by accident or miscalculation or malicious intent or whatever it may be, conflict escalating out of control, that these weapons are unleashed, I'm sure then that if we should be among those who would happen to survive that, the question would be, every one of us would ask, why didn't somebody do something? How in the world could we let this kind of absolute horror take place? We're in a situation, one of the greatest ironies of human history. These weapons are from our defense department. They're supposed to defend us. And yet, if these weapons are used, they will not defend us. They will guarantee our destruction. And so it seems well that we ask ourselves and ask now what we can do. And we take a look now in terms of attitudes toward war. If there's no cure for a nuclear war, that's what the Physicians for Social Responsibility keep stressing over and over again. There's no cure, that's only prevention, and so the time to act and to think is now. Now, what I want to do in the part of the time that is left here is to take a very brief look at three different attitudes toward war that have been present within the history of the Christian Church. And I'm indebted here to Roland Bainton, especially his book, Christian Attitudes Toward War and Peace. When Jerry Folk and I visited last night about what his plans were, he plans to go into some of this too, so I don't think it's going to be totally repetitious of what he's doing, but I hope it can be complementary toward one another. The three attitudes that Christians have had toward war, as Roland Bainton has pointed out, are pacifism, the just war, and the crusade. We want to take a look at each one of those briefly in turn. For the first 300 years, up till about the time of Constantine, Bainton maintains, and I think most historians would agree with this, that the Christian Church was essentially pacifist. And I want to make a couple distinctions immediately related to pacifism, because I think the word pacifism just conjures up all kinds of images in people's minds. And the first thing I want to stress is to underscore the fact that the word pacifist is spelled with a C and not with an S. It comes from the word peace. It does not come from the word passive. And some of the people who have been among the world's leading pacifists, such as Gandhi, for example, have gone to great lengths to stress that they are not being passive, that pacifism is active. It is active love. It is active power of a nonviolent kind at work in the world. In fact, when Gandhi was pushed a bit on this, he could say, for example, that the best thing you should do, the thing that people ought to do, they ought to resist evil nonviolently, with truth force, love force, and so on. The worst thing, he said, people could do is simply to be passive, do nothing, just simply submissive. That's awful. Better, he said, to take up arms than to do nothing at all. That's interesting, I think, kind of comment coming from Gandhi. Gandhi had a lot of interesting kind of statements. He could say, for example, that the only people in the world who don't recognize that Jesus was a pacifist are the Christians. Other people, he says, study the New Testament, see that theme, a very strong theme, in the life and teaching, and certainly especially in the cross of Christ. Gandhi, it was parenthetically, I was asked one time, what do you think was the great, what's the greatest enemy of Jesus Christ in the world? And he paused for a few moments and said, Christianity. Now, I don't think that's the whole truth, but there's enough truth in that to make all of us pause and to reflect a bit. But I underscore at first that the first thing about pacifism, it is a position of strength and not of weakness. It is active and not passive. It is standing for and working for peace. Blessed are the peacemakers, said Jesus, not just the peacekeepers, the people who do the things that make for peace. The second distinction I'd like to make in connection with pacifism is that when we stress the fact that the Christian church for the first 300 years, and I think we do well to think of the fact, that's a long time, 300 years, was essentially pacifist. I think there are some evidences, there is some evidence historically that there were some Christians who did participate in police forces. And that prompts me to seek to make a distinction between a police force and an army going to war. And again, to me, that's a very significant distinction. A police force operates under a rule of law. It operates with severe limitations on its physical use of weapons and violence. It operates in conjunction with courts. The purpose of a police officer is not to kill people, if at all possible, you to bring people into a court where they are tried for their crime or whatever, and not just to kill people. I've never heard of a responsible police force evaluating its success, for example, in terms of body counts, amount of destruction, and so on. And yet this is the way in which the success often of war is evaluated. War, rather, has its aim, the destruction of the enemy. We could go into all the stuff about Clausewitz and all the theories of war. We have time to go into all that today. But I think it's very important for us to ponder that kind of distinction and to realize that there are many people who are pacifists who are not opposed to the use of police power. John Yoder, in that little book, nevertheless, divides up, I think, is it 17 or 23 or whatever, you know, varieties of religious pacifism. And I think when we deal with pacifism, it's important for us to remember there are these kind of distinctions. And I think often we do not make those distinctions carefully enough. Sometimes when I talk about these things, people have come to me and said, well, don't you think we should have police on the streets of our city? I think we should have police on the streets of the city. I think it's a marvelous thing, for example, that we have fire in our furnace back in Minnesota in the wintertime. But that does not mean I believe in arson. It doesn't mean I believe in, you know, saving the city by burning it down. I think that there are very great differences between the fire in the furnace and the fire gone wild burning down the city. And it seems to me the same time there are very great distinction between the use of responsible police power under law in connection with courts and so on, and the operation of war. I want to get to some other distinctions on that, but I don't want to do it all at this point. Anyway, in terms of pacifism, I think we should take a new look at pacifism. Most of us have never looked at it very seriously at all. It's been kind of a joke to us. To take a look at Jesus' teaching about loving our enemies, Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount and Sermon on the Plain. Tomorrow in the Bible study, we want to ponder some of the teaching of Jesus in the Sermon on the Plain in the 6th chapter of Luke. That's a remarkable and significant passage. We think of the word of Jesus to Peter. Put your sword into its place. All who take the sword will perish by the sword. Where is the place of the sword? Is it perhaps limited and restricted to the place of police power? In Luke 22, the parallel passage, Jesus says to Peter, in terms of the sword, he's taking out the sword and using it, no more of this. As a Lutheran, I can't help but wonder if we Lutherans had taken that statement of Jesus as seriously as we have taken the statements earlier in Luke about the sacraments, if we had taken those with equal seriousness, what the history of the Christian church would be. I think there could very well be a very significant difference. When I think about passages in relation to the sword, some come back and say, Jesus taught us, you know, that he came not to bring peace, but to bring a sword. I think it's very clear, if you look at the parallel there in Luke, that that use of the sword is symbolic and not literal. In Luke, it says that I do not think I came to bring peace. I've come to bring division. I've come to set persons against members of their family and so on. And one could just as well use that passage in our context to say that people are to stand with Christ against the sword. That's the kind of division he came to bring. We're to take a stand over against the patterns of conformity of our society. And above all, as we look to Christ, of course, we think of the cross of Christ. And in our session on Thursday, we want to focus more specifically on the cross of Christ, not just as the witness to our redemption and salvation, but the cross of Christ as it witnesses to the cost of Christ-like nonconformity in a sinful world. The cross of Christ as it witnesses to a Christ alternative way of meeting evil and oppression. Not with the sword, but with love. Love that cares enough to match its capacity to endure suffering against the capacity of others to inflict it. First then, we've thought a little bit about pacifism. The next thing I want to say something about is about just war. Going back to the time of Augustine and others, and on through the history of the main line of the Christian church, there were developed theories of just war, and I think, again, that Jerry Folk is going to go into this in more detail than I would wish to do. War had to be a last resort. The cause of the war had to be just. You couldn't just have a war to, you know, God of greed, to gather more territory and so on. War could be just only on one side, couldn't be just on both sides. It had to spare the innocent, children, women, elderly, and so on. And one of the most significant tests, the potential good that was believed to come from the war had to exceed the evil of the war. Now again, briefly, just a couple of comments in relation to this, and we could go into all kinds, we could spend all day talking about these kind of things, but I think one of the most interesting things to me about this just war business is that in the discussion of just war, the way that conversation usually is gone is that we start thinking along the lines I mentioned earlier, are there ever situations in which it's just to go to war? And we usually manage to figure out some situations, we say, yes, I think it is. You know, just, most people would say it was just to go to war against Hitler. That was a just war. And so we jump from that there are some circumstances in which it is just to go to war. We jump from that to, in effect, saying it's always just to go to war. If that seems an exaggeration, I'd like to give a challenge to you. I've heard it said, and I've never heard anybody refute this. There may be exceptions to it. That in all of these years, going back now about 1,500 years and more, the just war has been the official teaching of most of the mainline Protestant and Roman Catholic churches. There has never been one case in any country, anywhere, where the majority of Christian people in that country have said, this war is unjust, we are going to refuse to fight in it. The just war has always turned out to be the war we are fighting. The just side has always turned out to be our side. And so what has happened is we've had this tragic situation in which Christian people who the Bible says aren't even supposed to take each other into the pagan courts, Christian people are slaughtering each other on both sides of the war. We had this down the Falkland Islands situation. You have people, you see the pictures of them going to prayer on both sides and ending up killing each other. And it would seem rather safe to say that what we need to do when we think about just war, we probably shouldn't even just talk about just war. We should also talk, we should put it always just/unjust war. And we should emphasize that one of the chief purposes of the just-unjust war teaching, and you go back to Augustine or Luther or St. Thomas, anybody, one of the chief things in that teaching is that there are certain wars in which it is not just for a Christian to fight. There are wars in which Christians are not to go to take up arms and battle. That's very, very clear in the teaching of just-unjust war, and yet, in terms of its practice, it has simply not been practiced at all. A second thing in relation to this just-unjust war business is that if we even just briefly think about these tests, we see that in a day of doomsday weapons, war, whatever it may have been in days past, flunks those tests. And I think that the test, the most obvious one that it flunks, is that it creates more evil than it does good. It destroys everything it's supposed to defend. It is, to underscore what I mentioned a little bit ago, it, instead of defending us, guarantees our destruction. There is no problem in the world that is made better by dropping a nuclear weapon on it. There's no problem so terrible that it's better to say, let's wait one more day before we drop an H-bomb on it. There is no end that justifies the means of the use of these doomsday weapons. There is no evil within human history that justifies even the potential destruction of human history. The use of those weapons is really as irrational as curing your headache by cutting off your head. It is as irrational as burning down the house to get rid of the termites, sinking the ship to get rid of the rats. Now, I do not need to be a lover of headaches to oppose the doctor giving me that prescription to cure my headache by cutting off my head. I don't have to love rats or termites to oppose burning down the house or sinking the ship. Nor do I have to be one who loves communism or tyranny or any of the other evils in the world to oppose saving America by destroying the world. And I think that that is exceedingly important thing for us to think about. And there's a lot of confused thinking, seems to me, in this regard. And part of it is expressed, for example, in that famous slogan, often quoted, you know, it's better to be dead than red. Well, maybe that's true in terms of some individual hero somewhere taking on tyrannical communism. Could well be true. But it's not true in terms of civilization itself. You're going to destroy the whole planet. And if that seems like a strange thing to say, we should go over and talk with people in Moscow or Warsaw or someplace and say, would you prefer to live here, or would you prefer to have us now drop a nuclear bomb on you? Or would we ask ourselves, would we prefer to have our children living today in Havana or Warsaw or Moscow or Peking someplace, or would we prefer to have them living in Hiroshima on August 6th of 1945? And I think that you universalize that over terms of the destruction of the whole planet, it becomes clear that, again, that there is no evil in history that justifies the destruction of history itself. And we could reverse this, of course, in the Soviet Union, too. There's no evil in capitalism and all of that that justifies, you know, saving the Soviet Union by destroying the world either. Now, there are all kinds of fears, of course, that fuel this kind of thinking. I think, again, we could take a long time and talk about some of these things, and I want to try to restrain myself a little bit and round this up. But someone asked the other day, he said, what you should talk about is something about the Soviet threat, and I don't want to say very much about that because the time gets away from us here. I think some of our fears really there are irrational, and this is not to paint the Soviet Union as being, you know, a place full of angels. I think the Soviet Union has as much sin in it as we do. I've had a few occasions of visiting with Soviet citizens. I think many of them lack a sense of original sin. At least the ones I talk to seem to not have the kind of, maybe they're not dare to say any comments critically of their own government and so on. And yet there is a sense in which this is a mutual kind of thing. We're not taking sides, one or the other. But in terms of the threat, I think just as it's true that the United States cannot conquer the Soviet Union. We had trouble enough in Vietnam. So it's true the Soviet Union cannot conquer the United States. We can destroy each other. make the rubble bounce and all of that, but we cannot conquer each other. The Soviet Union is having trouble enough in Afghanistan and Poland and so on. I think in terms of that, we should be realistic about that and not be driven into panic. Richard Barnett has made the comment that the Soviet Union is the only country in the world that is virtually surrounded by hostile communist powers. It may help us to ponder a little bit that situation, perhaps understand their paranoia as well. But moving on quickly, I think it is this kind of business of saving America by destroying the world is not only irrational, it is also, from a Christian perspective, it is also sin. That it would be wrong for us to save America if we could do so by only destroying the Soviet Union. And I think it's well for us also to stop and to ponder that a bit and to think about it. We could go on again at length here, the development of new thinking related to warfare, especially the development of what's called counterforce weapons. There's a book in the bookstore called The Counterforce Syndrome. I urge you to take a look at that. We could talk about deterrence. There are all kinds of problems with that, but there are even greater problems with war fighting and counterforce and all of that business. Counterforce means you target military targets, not just cities, and that may seem to be a much more moral thing to do, but that means inherently in that doctrine is you have to shoot first. There's no sense of shooting at an empty missile silo. It means you have to have an attack that takes place before you are attacked yourself, and that means you have to make a decision to either launch on warning or, as more recently they talk now, launch on assessment, which means you plan the annihilation of tens of millions of people without having been attacked yourself at all. And so some of us have come to believe that if it was a sin for Hitler to build and will to use the gas chambers, we believe it is also a sin to build and will to use these weapons of mass destruction. They do not pass the just war teaching. And the bishops, for example, of the Roman Catholic Church, who have taken a stand on this matter, are not being far out and radical kind of people, in the far out sense of the word radical at least, that they are simply being consistent with the teaching of the Roman Catholic Church for 1,500 years. And they say that the use of these weapons is not just. Now, we could talk about, and again, I think this is something that Jerry Folk is going to be discussing. There are all kinds of other effects of nuclear weapons besides their use. We are spending now approximately, or plan to spend, $1.6 trillion on military purposes during this current five-year period. I heard someone speak recently who was absolutely appalled that the national debt had just exceeded $1 trillion in the whole history of the country. And yet we think about the fact that if we could limit our military spending to only about $120 billion a year, which ought to be quite a lot in peacetime, we could pay off the whole national debt of our national history during this five-year period through that saving. Eisenhower talked about how every bomb that is built and so on robs from the poor and the hungry of the earth. We live in a world where there is great starvation and great human need, and yet we think of these amounts of money that absolutely, again, boggle the imagination. Then finally, I want to, having said a little bit about pacifism and just war, I'd like to say something about the third attitude toward war, which has been held historically by Christians, which is the crusade or the holy war. Now, that may seem one that we don't have to talk about because it's so far removed from us. And yet, if we think about it, maybe it isn't so far removed from us. In many ways, the Vietnam War was a crusade. It was a holy war, a just cause. In many ways, I think it is true the whole arms race is a crusade. And presented and understood to be a holy kind of cause. And what happens in those kind of holy causes, and somebody has said that wars are much more humane if you keep God out of them, and there's some rationale for that, because if we see ourselves, or any one side, see itself as being totally righteous and justified, and God's on our side, and on the other side aren't even people anymore, they're dehumanized or even demonized, then anything goes in that kind of war. And so what happens in these kind of situations is you have the development, really, of a basic kind of idolatry, an idolatry of the nation, idolatry of military power, and a demonization and dehumanization of the people on the other side. I think it's significant that Robert J. Lifton, who has done extensive writing on this, he has a great big book, for example, called The Broken Connection, talks about the nuclear deity. Luther said, that in which you trust for your salvation, that is your God. And I think that nuclear power has become that kind of, or has at least been, maybe it's fading a bit, the deity, it has been presented, understood to be the source of our energy and of our security. It had great promise. I think the word nuclear deity is not far from the mark when we think about that. We can easily think about, the idolatry of the state and the military power, Hitler and Stalin and so on. I think there's a great deal of that in the Soviet Union today. That I'm not an expert on the Soviet Union. One of the most significant things I've read on this subject was Alva Myrdal's book, The Game of Disarmament. And she really says, in effect, a plague on both your houses. And I wonder as I read that, how different we may look in the sight of God in terms of this kind of idolatry. Isn't that to make these kind of comments here? I thank God I live in a free country where you can make them. The same speech should be made in the Soviet Union. Maybe you needed more there than here. But we begin with ourselves and with our part in this. And in terms of this idolatry, just a final thought on this, and then I'll draw this together and sum it up. But I think it's significant, as has been some have pointed out, that these gods, these false gods, the god of nation and the god of military power, and we can think of a lot of other false gods as well, these are not jealous gods. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is a jealous God. We could take a look at the Old Testament, the accounts there of the Ten Commandments and so on. It's not just, you should have no other gods before me, but really it says, you should have no other gods, period. But these false gods don't have any such exclusive claim. They are glad to have us worship other gods. We can go to church on Sunday. We can say our prayers. Just serve them the rest of the week. I remember by way of an illustration of this that some years ago, I was involved in a counseling session with a woman who was married and she was involved in an extramarital affair. And in the course of our conversation, we talked about a lot of things. And one of the things we talked about was what effect this affair was having on her relationship with her husband. And she pointed out to me, that really wasn't having any bad effect at all. Everything was going on very well there. And then apparently sensing that I really didn't know very much about kind of the ground rules of having extramarital affairs, she explained to me that when you have an extramarital affair, of course it is understood by the people having the affair when they're married to somebody else that they do not expect faithfulness to each other. They expect there's going to be a continued relationship, including a continued sexual relationship with the marital partner. That's the way it is. You accept that. And in some way, I think of that in terms of these non-jealous gods. They say, fine, pray. That's wonderful. Have lots of prayer, more prayer. Have prayer in the White House. Have prayer in the schools. Have prayer everywhere. And when the final hour of your life comes, you can abandon us altogether. We can't help you anyway. Then you can trust in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the God and Father and Mother, as we heard this morning, of our Lord Jesus Christ. But now just serve us and obey us. There's something terribly dangerous about this. Duane Scribner mentioned this morning in our session that he didn't care too much for the loose use of the word demonic, and I think we need that reminder. But there are some dangers that are so subtle and so pervasive and so powerful that I would be bold enough to say that I think the subtle temptation to worship the god of a national militarism at least verges on the possibility of being demonic. One last question and one last final kind of observation here. The question is, what is the end of this arms race road on which we are traveling? Now, I must say to you that I hope the end of that road, if we continue to travel it, is a world of justice and peace and freedom. The people who advocate it say that's what they seek, and I don't deny them that good intention. But I must confess that I cannot believe that is the end of that road. I would be exceedingly delighted if any one of you could show me that all of the concerns that I've expressed today are unfounded. My situation is similar to that if I'd been riding on the Titanic. I've been up above there, I look ahead, there's some icebergs out there, and I get really panicky, and I get worried. I think we're on a collision course for disaster. Now, if I had been that passenger, I would have been glad to have been convinced by somebody that those fears were totally unfounded. And that the ship was not going to end up in a few hours on the bottom of the sea. So also, when I have these fears that we are on a collision course with the greatest disaster in human history, with a Holocaust that makes Hitler's Holocaust pale in comparison, it's beyond anything that Hitler could ever have devised or even imagined. If you can convince me that I'm wrong, I will give you at least one big Holden hug. I've been glad to be wrong, delighted to be wrong. The second, the final thought here is that as we look back in human history, I think we are amazed that Christian people, for example, supported the institution of slavery. That Christian people, pastors in Germany, signed personal pledges of allegiance to Adolf Hitler. And we think to ourselves, if we had been there, my, how courageous we would have been. We would have been people advocating freedom for the slaves. We'd have taken the lead in that. We'd have stood against Hitler with Bonhoeffer. How courageous we'd have been. And yet we only, as we look at ourselves, we have to know that we all tend much more toward conformity than we tend toward Christ-likeness. And if we'd been there, we likely would have conformed and drifted along like everybody else. Well, we weren't there, but we're here now. And some of us wonder, at least, is it not time for us to take a new look at our whole attitudes toward participation in and support of the institution of war? And we've tried today to take a little bit of new look at that. And then also to go beyond that, to take a new look at alternatives to war. The question that's always raised when we get to this point, and I'm going to quit here in 30 seconds, is to say that, well, what you say is true, but we can't do anything about it. I hope on Thursday to share a few things that would at least suggest that in Christ there are some other things we can do about it. We're talking about, sometimes I heard Billy Graham recently talk out east, and he sometimes talks about the coming Holocaust as if it were a hurricane coming off the ocean or something. We're creating this thing. We've built this monster, and if we have built it, perhaps by the grace of God and the power of the Holy Spirit, we can do something to unbuild it. And on Thursday, we want to try to take a look at least, or hint at least, at some of the possibilities for those kinds of alternatives to war. I've used up much more time than I intended to do. We have a few minutes left, and I'd like to open it up for your comments and reactions and rebuttals and all of that. I think it's an excellent question. How do we respond to this? What can you do, and so on? I think one of the key things in all of this has to do with the whole discussion about inferiority and superiority. We talk about the window of vulnerability. We are inferior. All of that kind of business. Incidentally, I wrote recently to the President and to the Secretary of Defense and asked them if they would please do three things, or in connection with, I guess I could say, do three things. One was if they would send me the names of a dozen admirals and generals who would swap our military situation with that of the Soviet Union. The second would be to swap our situation of NATO with that of the Warsaw Pact. As I mentioned before, they can't even be sure, if you get into conflict, which way some of their so-called allies are going to fight. And the third thing is to swap our strategic situation in the world with that of the Soviet Union. I got a form letter kind of thing back, which did not list those names of any admirals or generals, because I don't think there are any admirals or generals that would make that kind of a swap. That the key word, if you want to go with deterrence doctrine, the key word is not inferiority or superiority, the key word is sufficiency.
And there are people, for example, like George Kennan, who say we have such vast overkill capacity, we could unilaterally reduce our military, nuclear weapons and so on by 50% and not risk anything at all. There are people who would say that if 100 weapons are delivered onto either one, the United States or Soviet Union would totally devastate the country. It's a catastrophe beyond anything in history. And we think about, we've got 30,000 building three more a day. You know, it's like, in a way, this whole argument is if I've got a 410-gauge shotgun against your head and you've got a 12-gauge against mine, there's not much talking about inferiority and superiority. I mean, we're essentially equal. Or as I heard somebody say, like a couple of boys playing in a garage up to their knees in gasoline, and one kid's got 8 matches and the other's got 12, and they've got a big fight about who's superior. Well, I think that one of the first things needs to be said is we have to have some kind of rationality of limitation here in terms of declaring, instead of bad-mouthing our military all the time, to listen to people like LaRocque and others who say we have such vast overkill sufficiency that we need not respond to this out of such panic and such fear. And we can take even some unilateral steps toward mutual disarmament without any great risk involved. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's a few thoughts that come to mind when you raise it. Other comments or questions?
Yes.
Okay, first. You up here first and then think.
The one argument I find difficult to deal with is the one that says it is more dangerous for us to talk now and press for a freeze or disarmament or something than it is to continue in the way we are. I agree with all that you've said about insanity and so on and so forth, but there are those people who say we are unbalancing the situation and that holds more peril of nuclear holocaust than it does to continue in the present path.
I guess my response to that would be similar to what I was stressing before, that I think there is in a situation of vast overkill capacities.
Yes,
then the situation of balance becomes quite insignificant. And I think that most of the people that I respect, and I use this illustration about asking for the names of the generals who would swap and so on, would not swap. We are not in such a position of vast inferiority. I talked with some people out east who were involved in a group called the Boston Study Group that wrote the book, The Price of Defense, and so on. I went to their office and visited with them and so on. And they talk about the window of vulnerability. They say it's far more vulnerable for the Soviet Union. We are so far ahead in all kinds of anti-submarine warfare and other kind of stuff that in terms of development of a theoretic first strike that most people think would be absolutely crazy for anybody to try that, because of all the possibilities of it failing in so many, many different ways, but in terms of a theoretic capacity for first strike again, destroying their forces, we are far ahead of the Soviet Union. For just one thing, for example, we've got about 20-some percent, whatever it is, 25% of our missiles that are land-based. We always hear about this fantastic danger to vulnerability or land-based missiles. We've got the other 75% are on submarines and all kinds of other places all over the place. So we could, some have said, LaRocque, for example, others have said, the best thing we could do with those land-based missiles is simply remove them. We don't need them at all. They're not necessary.
I don't think that's what I'm saying. I think what the discussion is more of when people in the United States in general press for a freeze, for a disarmament, this encourages adventurism on the part of the Soviet nation. This unbalances, this tender balance that we have. The
specific freeze proposal is for a mutual and verifiable and bilateral kind of freeze where you have agreement actually on both sides. There are many people who say that isn't even necessary. You could have a freeze for 2-3 years again without risking anything. See what their response would be. I think historically the United States has led the arms race almost every step of the way. They have matched what we have done. And I don't see the argument then doesn't seem to me to follow to say if we would stop now, say we're going to stop in the development of new weapons and so on, and the testing and production deployment of these new weapons, that I think we have a chance to see that they might also stop. And we have plenty of historic precedents that if we don't stop, they're going to match everything we do as they've done before. And we match what they do. That somebody somewhere along the line has to say one significant word, and that word is enough.